Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis, and on our best days, some insight into the news media issues of the week. And we are glad to have you with us. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the... editor at large of the Times Union. How about that? A fine new title. Thank you very much. Alan Shartok is here, CEO and poobah of Northeast Public Radio.
And that's a fine new title, too, poobah.
Poobah. Well, thank you to Gilbert and Sullivan for that. Rosemary Armeo, investigative journalist, is here. And professor, how are you?
Good.
And Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady and vice president of the New York Press Association.
I am happy to be here.
You are happy. Well, that's good because there's people scowling at the other end of the table in front of those microphones.
I deny it.
He denies whatever it is. We have a listener in California who writes to us, Matt, who says he was accidentally searching for a different program that has the word media in it, and he came across our podcast. He says, it turns out that a lot of things that are of concern to you are on my mind out here on the West Coast, too. So thank you, Matt, for writing to us. Here's his good question. He says, is there any good reason for news outlets to keep publishing editorials and op-eds instead of just straight news? He says, as a sophisticated, quote unquote, adult reader, it still takes me effort to sort out, oh, this is a news analysis piece versus, oh, this is an editorial versus this is an op-ed. Ah, here's straight news. He's a digital New York Times subscriber. Though, Alan, he points out, he only reads it during the day, not several times at night.
Uh-huh.
Aha.
Well, I do, and every sleep book says don't do what I do,
right,
which is to wake up and look at the New York Times in the middle of the night.
Imagine how productive, and imagine your longevity if you would have a good night's sleep.
Yeah, well, longevity is very important to me, Rex, as you point out.
So can I make the point that there are a million good reasons to keep editorials, opinions, op-eds? Those are one of the things that draw people to media companies, to papers, and it's one of the true value propositions we offer our readers. We could do a better job of labeling them, especially online. Maybe that would solve the confusion. But if you cut out those, you really cut out the heart of a newspaper, I think.
Well, also, I hate to do this to you because I know it's going to set you all off. I think sometimes the slant of the New York Post or some of the other places labeled as straight reporting is not straight reporting. It's editorializing, too. And I certainly agree with you, Judy. I know that in the Troy Record, one of the newspapers that carries my column, they always put me next to a conservative commentator because they must have been getting plenty of complaints about my left-wing leanings.
Well, that's one way to do it, is to have, you know, people on each side. But this guy's point is, Matt, sorry, this guy, he says, given that the distinction between op-ed editorial and straight news is not clear and that opinion pieces might be interfering with subscriptions and revenue, that's what he says. He says that people are alienated by reading opinion. As opposed to Judy's point that people actually like to see it. So,
well, you know, everybody's entitled to their opinion. We're about to have a fund drive. It's going to be the fastest fund drive in history. People have been sending in thousands of dollars. It's unbelievable. And yet you get a phone call from somebody saying, I'll never give you a dime because I know you're turning off a lot of people by asking for money. So, you know, there are a lot of opinions out there.
I took many of those calls where someone threatened to cancel. I'm going to cancel my paper because you wrote this editorial. And I always would follow up with my circulation director, and they never canceled. It was an empty threat.
That's so funny.
Well, you know, one of the interesting new developments is the transparency that lies behind some of the opinion presentations. We haven't done this, but, you know, the New York Times giving you insight, a picture of how they went about making their presidential endorsements in the Democratic side.
Don't get me started.
Well, they didn't actually make a presidential endorsement.
They endorsed two.
Right.
Who knew you could get away with that?
Rosemary, you guys have been doing this show for 25 years. Haven't we had this argument and discussion for at least that length of time? I'm frankly bored by it. Newspapers have to be, in fact, all media outlets have to be many things, straight news and analysis and opinion and columns, and the better written and the more juicy the topics, people are going to read it. And the form just simply is not important. I feel that more and more these days.
Well, we're sorry we're letting you down.
Yeah, I know. I think the New York Times, I mean, okay, so their editorial endorsement this year was different. I applaud them for trying something different.
Okay, I know that I won't get through the sentence, Rosemary.
No, I'm going to bite it right off, Alan. Right, like this. Yeah. try it again.
Ouch, that really hurts. But you know, we did read the person's letter, the guy's letter, and he makes a point. He's interested. You may be tired of this argument as a person who has gone around with this many, many times, but people are still asking that question.
What about fact-checking? We get the same kind of complaints from people when we do fact-checks. People say, oh, that's just your excuse to give your opinion. Because, you know, frankly, the fact-checking that we've had to do most of recently that's made it so significant is Donald Trump.
Oh, you mean fact-checking on somebody like Trump?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Okay. You know, when you put in the claim and the reality, this is difficult when you've got a president who, frankly, lies constantly, not just in terms of perspective on things. You could give him his perspective that the United States was, what was the word that he used in his inaugural, how we were?
Carnage.
Carnage, yes, thank you. Carnage in the streets. So even if you let him get away with that kind of thing, you do need to do fact-checking, don't you, on the very substance of the claims that he's making that aren't true.
I'm feeling more and more like Nancy Pelosi. You can either be decorous and sit politely while he lies to it, or you can rip it to shreds. And frankly, I think we should be ripping.
Interesting.
Good for you, Rosemary.
And we should note that the fact-checkers also fact-check the left. And if you pay attention, you will see that they will take whatever Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or Adam Schiff says, and they will, if they say something that is not correct, they will call them on it. Mm-hmm. It's just that they don't do it as often. It is the stunning amount of lies. It is hard to keep track of, especially the repeated lies. And even people who get paid full-time to do this, I think they are growing weary of this.
But as Rex and you and Rosemary have all attested in the past, there are fewer and fewer extra dollars for people like fact-checkers and people in the so-called slot who do this work. And so I suspect we're going to get more and more lies getting through without being called.
Yeah, the propaganda is overwhelming.
It is.
And it's intended to be, and it's designed to be, and it is extremely effective.
So propaganda and stagecraft get some attention in the media. You know, in the president's State of the Union address, of course, there was the stagecraft of having the First Lady award the Presidential Medal of Freedom to Rush Limbaugh sitting up in the balcony a day after he had announced that he was battling advanced lung cancer. So this was stagecraft, but it's not as though you cannot cover that because it did happen. But the question is, how much do you make of stagecraft? How much do you make of Nancy Pelosi ripping up the president's speech? Was that stagecraft? Was that plotted in advance? Or was that something that we ought to be paying attention to?
Yes, we ought to be paying attention to it because not even just the people who viewed it, because I'm sure that most of them saw it the day after, the way we watch Saturday Night Live, you watch it in YouTube clips. So people are paying attention to it, which means the media has to pay attention to. And I think generally they did a good job. They, like me, applauded it. I thought it was a masterful State of the Union. It's certainly the most interesting one I ever watched. On the other hand, I know exactly what he was doing, and I've spoken about that, too. It's hiding his lies, hiding the, what did Pelosi call it, the manifesto of mistruths. There's something true in what she said as well. And the media did cover it. I think they did a good job on it in general.
Well, I'm concerned a little bit, Rosemary, for whatever it's worth, that people might misinterpret you as saying, well, he did a good job in the way he constructed the speech and put it across. They might think you were applauding what he said.
I don't applaud anything Trump does.
That's pretty definitive. Yeah.
So the president ignores her outstretched hand, looking to shake his hand. She rips up the speech.
But Rex, can I stop you a minute? Because the press didn't even report that. The press reported that he did not shake her hand. It's unclear whether she made him see it. He also, and the press, I only know it from the press, didn't shake Pence's hand either. So they were not as biased as I am against Trump. I don't cover Trump, and there's a reason for it. But I did not find the coverage to be biased against him.
I don't know.
It was very objective.
I don't know. I watched the clip on the television and saw her outstretched hand. I think it was pretty obvious. And he just ignored her during that thing. And I think that that...
But see, that's an opinion, and you watch the actual video. I saw two, and I saw him hand one tablet to Pence and then one to Nancy and then spin around and give a speech. I don't know if he ignored her or not.
Yeah, I think
she acted like she...
I think the mainstream media did a good job of covering, and it was social media that went crazy with ripping up the speech and the handshake, and that everybody was performing for social media. And ultimately, that's what the bulk of Americans saw, because they pay attention to social media. They're not reading, they're not watching in real time or making their own conclusions.
Well, I don't think there you go. I think it's quite the opposite. I do not really do enough on social media. I know I should do more. And anything that I'm reporting having seen, I saw on the television and saw people talking about out there.
Right. And it was often on the morning programs, where on the network morning programs, where they do pull that out. But I was watching on MSNBC and CNN, and they were saying, well, it's not clear. He didn't shake Pence's hand. But clearly, if you've been in the position where you've had your hand stretched out and the person hasn't taken it, it is awkward.
He's a germaphobe. Why would he?
He had no trouble shaking all those hands. Why would, sycophantic Republican saying, great speech, sir.
Why would he shake Pence's hand?
And then the content of the speech, I really actually don't even know what he, like, I always look to the State of the Union to give me a sense of the State of the Union and where are we going to go in the future, but I can't believe anything he says. We have a big stack of paper here with all the lies he said in it, so I'm nowhere. I'm actually behind where I was before because I don't have a good sense of where my country's going.
He
told us. He said the State of the Union is the best it's ever been.
Oh, yeah, he told us. Did the theatrics, though, in a way, turn the address into basically a personality clash between a Republican man who says he's turning around the country and a Democratic woman who says he's a liar? Isn't that sort of what comes out of it? The bottom line becomes a pretty black and white, stark contrast between the two because of the stagecraft.
Well, the thing is, she was right and he was wrong.
I can envision that next year, or the stagecraft being that we're going to have dazzling lights and we're going to have the guy from the WWF announcing him. He's going to come in with a boxer's outfit on, and it's going to be a real show. We just started this year. It's just going to get worse.
So talking about whether editorials are out of date, is the State of the Union out of date? Do we need one anymore? This is not what the Constitution envisioned when it asked for a report to Congress from the president.
Yeah, George Washington just sent it up. He was insulted once and he didn't go anywhere.
A written report, right.
In the state of New York, our governor has changed tradition with the State of the State, which used to be a fairly staid thing in the chamber of the Assembly, the same way that the State of the Union is in the chamber of the House of Representatives. And he's turned his budget presentation and State of the State into sort of the same big theatrical thing in the Civic Center, whatever you call the thing, that place. So
you know what? I think, Rex, you have a very good point. But I have a reason that I think he's done it this way, why he's moved into this much bigger place.
Andrew Cuomo, the governor.
Yeah,
yes. Why is that?
Well, because he sees that he can load it with all of his people. And they can come, and when it's applause time, he gets the applause.
Right. And it is the communication, I think, to the point that Judy's making about what happens next year. It is more effective communication when you can fill the screen with visuals instead of just standing there talking, which is what the State of the Union and the State of the State have been. You know, I was struck during the impeachment debate that the producers of that in the Senate, during the Senate trial, allowed full screen takeover of the visuals that were being presented by both sides, because that meant that people watching at home had a visual presentation, which is, of course, how we now absorb information much more than just on the words. I was surprised by that. I thought that it would be more staid, more like the Clinton impeachment trial, just guys standing up there talking. And I think that this recognition that people absorb information differently these days, maybe it's not a bad thing that the government pay attention to that and make an effort to produce a message that's a little bit more in touch with how people can understand.
Perhaps
things.
They could put courts in the Supreme, cameras rather, into the Supreme Court.
Imagine that, cameras in the court.
But what did you think about Limbaugh getting the Presidential Medal of Freedom?
Oh, for heaven's sake.
I think the Medal of Freedom, which was initiated by Kennedy, is another outdated institution. It's set up so that the president can give it to whoever he wants. Limbaugh is not the first objectionable, although to my mind the worst. He's not the first inappropriate person to get it. Tiger Woods made me angry, and they're not all Mother Teresa and Rosa Parks.
On the other hand, the two you've cited are Trump honorees.
George Bush did a few that I didn't like also. I'm not coming to mind right now, but it's just like pardons, you know. Other presidents have abused it. Certainly Clinton did. But Trump has raised abuse of presidential powers to a new level.
So Edward R. Murrow got one, Walter Cronkite, Tom Brokaw, Lowell Thomas, some real greats in broadcasting industry. But you're right, Rosemary, they have given out, they sometimes give them out like candy.
Yeah.
Limbaugh, in my opinion, is one of the key factors behind the alienation, the yes. divisions of this country. When his show started airing regularly in 91, something like that, I think, is when it began to get national syndication. It was a lot like local talk radio had been for a little while. But this national audience that he assembled was such that it really led to the Democratic takeover of the House that made Newt Gingrich the House Speaker. We can't forget, though,
the Republican takeover.
The stuff that he did, you know, the sketches he did. Remember this terribly objectionable when Barack the Magic Negro was this song that he did. And he has done terrible things.
And women, too. You must mention that, as misogyny is also being reflected in the tenor today. He held up a picture of Chelsea Clinton, then 13 years old, and said, "Oh, there's a dog in the White House."
And let's not forget his attacks on Nancy Pelosi. And she was sitting there at the State of the Union and had to watch him get the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
And Trump supporters are all over the social media decrying her disrespect that she didn't stand when that man got a medal, M-E-T-A-L, may I point out.
Oh, dear. Share your views with us, please.
These are the times.
Media@WAMC.org. Media@WAMC.org is how you can share your thoughts about this if you can bear to continue to think about it. All right. By the way, just before leaving the topic, remember the exclusion of CNN from the annual lunch that the president has with television anchors. Not a great fan of the president lunching with TV anchors off the record before the State of the Union anyway, but it is significant that he excluded CNN and the other anchors, just went along to the White House and had a nice lunch with the president anyway.
That's on the other media. I mean, the behavior of this administration, we've pointed out many times, is objectionable, but we in the media don't stick together against that behavior, and that adds to it. It makes it effective.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the practice from the get-go. It's an off-the-record discussion. They want to rub shoulders in the White House. It's a perk of the job, but it's just wrong. My understanding is they also have lunch with Nancy Pelosi. It's part of the tradition, too, this underplayed. But it is supposed to be an off-the-record conversation, but apparently some of the information leaked out, too.
So, Judy, did you go to the governor's
Never was invited, but I wouldn't have gone.
I got invited, and I knew that governor very well, Mario Andrews. Of course, Andrew, who I've interviewed many times. I never went either.
I've twice been, once with each Cuomo, I've been to Christmas parties at the...
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I got
But that. I have more disrespect for reporters who go and then flaunt the rules. Do you remember the Jaime Town controversy? Jesse Jackson had, it was off the record, and reporters agreed to it, and then said, oh, no, this is so outrageous, you know, this anti-Semitic attitude that we need to report it. And that's not right either.
Well, what wasn't right is that Jesse Jackson said it. I mean, in other words, there are many of us who have always said, if you say something your mother told you and you don't want to see it on the front page of the New York Times, don't say it.
So you think that, I'm trying to remember the controversy, Jesse was supposedly in an off-the-record situation,
correct,
but because he so egregiously said New York City is Jaime Town, the reporter broke the rule.
It was a black reporter, and he felt that he just simply had to come out with this, that this was too important, so he violated the rules. But I don't think it works that way. Mm-hmm. I would have hated it, but if I had agreed to go into an off-the-record session, you either convince him, look, I can't keep that off the record, you have to give me permission, or you don't write about it.
Mm-hmm. Have any of you ever violated the off-the-record rule?
Not to my knowledge, but I do recall one of my worst offenses was in a conversation with a young woman who didn't really realize that I was going to be reporting what she said. I was sent by my editors to do reporting on development in the Adirondacks. I was working for a downstate newspaper. Yeah. And a woman took me through this new development that was going up in North Creek. And I had said, I'm from Newsday, but she didn't really have in mind that she was talking to a reporter. Yeah, I didn't have my notebook out, and I quoted her, and it was unfair.
I know Rosemary's admonition about saying things that we've said over 25 years. However, there is one, and that is that we know that sometimes when we are talking like, as you just said, when we're talking with somebody who is a novice and who doesn't know the rules, you give them a little extra as opposed to when you're dealing with a politician who should know better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the controversy with Mike Pompeo talking to the NPR reporter, and his staffer said, come in and talk to him and don't bring your recorder. And somehow in that, in her mind, or maybe in his, that meant off the record. That's not off the record. That's don't, you can't take notes. And she held him to it. And I have no pity for him at all. He's in a high level official. He knows how the game is played. But you're right. If you're talking to a high school kid who's saying something that you know is going to come off as racist, even. I've had an example with that, speaking on a Martin Luther King Day. This 16-year-old said something and said, that's exactly what you said. Please be careful because I'm not going to use it, but other people might.
Mm-hmm. Sure, exactly.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
You change that.
People don't know that reporters, journalists make those kinds of decisions all the time. I mean, we really do bear in mind this third tenet of the Code of Ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists, minimize harm. We don't try to hurt people. Your truth-telling responsibility sometimes will hurt people enough, as it is. You know, if you're telling the truth about someone, you know that it can create pain, but you don't intentionally go out and inflict harm if you intend to be an ethical journalist.
You know, Rex and I both know a particularly difficult reporter who used to be here and used to be very close to the rules. And one day he called me and said, you know, you said this. And I said, no, I didn't. And he said, well, let me go and check my notes, which I interpreted to mean he was recording. He was recording the program.
Uh-huh.
Or did he have just a notebook out? That's checking his notes.
Everything is possible.
Yes. All right.
Except with him.
Speaking of things off the record and or not, there's a little bit of a complex issue here involving economic data, which can make a difference of millions and millions of dollars in the pockets of certain people. And this has to do with a change that the Labor Department is doing on the use of economic data. So here's what happens. There is a secure room that reporters get to use for about a half hour, a so-called lockup room, maybe an hour before data is released by the government on economic reports, you know, things like retail sales, inflation reports. Reporters who generally cover the economy get access to this data in a locked room. They don't allow any recorders or anything. They have to surrender their cell phones before they go into the room. But it gives them a chance to see what the data is so that when it is released, the ordinary people who read this reporting get as close a chance to understand it as the automated information that basically nowadays scrapes the website and automatically institutes changes. This is now being taken away. The Labor Department says, nope, we're not going to give reporters early access to this. It looks to me an awful lot like just tit for tat. It looks to me like this is more of the administration trying to penalize reporters.
They don't give a good reason at all. And the good reason from the journalism perspective is it gives you a moment or a little bit of time to digest it and to come to an understanding of it before it's actually released. And it just reflects the lack of trust between the administration and the profession.
Well, as you know, the press is the enemy of the people, so says Trump. And this is just one more battle move in fighting that fight.
Well, I think it even is more sinister than that. I think there's tit for tat, but it's also you take away an advantage of a journalist to get
exactly
a story right, and you get to have a bigger voice, which I think is really what he wants to do.
Good point.
It goes along with taking away data off of databases, off of a lot of different things, even on pets and animal farms, you know, with puppy farms now, there's no data anymore. Why? It's all because journalists can't tell you stories that they don't want you to hear. But it's a half an hour. Come on, just take your hour and go someplace else and do it. You know, journalists also have to stop whining about this. The story is not about us. Okay, so we're not getting press briefings and we're not getting a half an hour to digest stuff, report a different way.
So do you think journalists are, as you say, whiners?
Yes.
There was a ton of whining with the Iowa results. It's like, oh, you know, why can't they get it right? Learn patience a little bit. You don't have to have the results at 9:05.
Or have it handed to you.
Go out and get it. Go to the precincts and get the information position yourself like we used to.
It was a disgrace.
It was a disgrace, and I don't think we covered it. We certainly didn't that night. Troy Price should be fired. I can't believe he's still in.
Just for our readers, Troy Price is
the head of the Iowa Democratic Party. And yes, it was a huge screw-up, and it may have been all technological, but the way he handled it was to shut down. He wasn't going to talk to anybody. He said one sentence in the public and then disappeared. I want to know everything about that guy. How did he get that job? Who else is there? How are they going to do it differently? What's going on right now? We still don't have. Do we have all the results yet?
Eventually this will all come out, I believe. But you're right. Yeah. There was a lot that was concealed to the great frustration of everybody. I was in Iowa at the time on caucus night. Huh. And I actually attended a middle school gymnasium where there were two caucuses going on at once, two precincts. It was kind of interesting to watch. I'd never seen it before. And you can see how the thing could just be cumbersome and break down. But that cumbersomeness, if that's a word, isn't where the problem was. These people all got there, tallied their votes, and did their job. The problem came in amassing it at a statewide level. And boy, the Iowa Democratic Party seems to have really blown it. And I think this will be the end of the Iowa caucus. We won't have it going this way anymore.
And by the way, it's being used against the Democratic Party nationally. They can't even run a caucus, you know.
Oh, yeah. I want to see a story about Tom Perez, too. I mean, this is a lot on his door. All this is at stake in 2020, and there is not top-level brilliance at the DNC.
Well, that's interesting. I wonder to what extent the National Party does have a hand in this. That software that seems to have been the problem in the app seems to have been, as near as we can tell, a state decision. So I think you could blame the Iowa Democrats. I think the National Democratic Party would be very happy to get rid of the Iowa caucuses.
They would, but this isn't the way to do it, Rex. You've got the first rollout of 2020, and no one, Tom Perez, didn't call and say, is everything checked out? We got no problems. Do you need anything from us? I don't know, because I haven't seen reporting on this.
Right. We don't know what the national role was, but I think that we will all be better served if the Iowa caucuses don't go forward the way they have been, and that you don't have a single Midwestern state that is 92% white making the decisions for the Democratic Party this early on.
It affects the Democrats far more than the Republicans in this year, and that's the effect of it, not on Iowa overall.
All right, that is all we have time for today. We end on a note of, I think we agree on this. Alan Shartok, Rosemary Arameo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. Gratitude to our producer, David Gustina, as always, and to you for joining us on The Media Project.
And to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.